And it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use, and I suggest that you have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write down things that might be of interest to you that come up during the newscasts. Here's the first of them. A tree planting is going to be happening on Sunday, November 17th at 10:30 in the morning. Leslie writes that we plan to plant 100 one-gallon Monterey cypress trees along Natural Bridges State Park and Swanton Boulevard in the city's right-of-way. We will need some additional volunteers for this project. If you're interested in planting trees on Sunday, the 17th of November, please come to the Natural Bridges State Park entrance on Swanton Boulevard at about 10:30 in the morning and be ready to work. If you want more information, contact Leslie Keedy. Her email address is lkeedy@cityofsantacruz.com. Once again, that email address, lkeedy@cityofsantacruz.com. And I think it's tentatively scheduled because it might be raining. Who knows? Coming up in Sacramento, there will be a wolf hearing. Californians, this is the chance you've been waiting for. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has rescheduled the public hearings on their misguided proposal to delist gray wolves across most of the United States, and they have extended the public comment period on this proposal until December 17th. We want to make sure that you're aware of this news. The Fish and Wildlife Service has decided to hold a public hearing in Sacramento. This is our best chance to stand up and fight for wolf conservation, and it will happen on Friday, November 22nd in Sacramento, California. We need you to stand up and make your voice heard. Your presence will make a huge impact in our fight to stop the delisting of the wolves. I hope you'll consider joining wolf advocates from across California to testify face-to-face in front of officials from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We'll let you know more details soon, but until then, here's the information on the hearing. It's November 22nd from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the Marriott Courtyard California Expo in Sacramento. And Defenders of Wildlife will continue working around the clock to bring you updates on the public hearing and training calls hosted by volunteers. Stay tuned, wolf advocates. Now is your chance to show the Fish and Wildlife Service what we're made of. And for the wolves, Jamie Rappaport Clark, Defenders of Wildlife. And you can find out more information at www.defenders.org. And once again, that is Friday, November 22nd, 6 to 8:30 p.m. at the Marriott Courtyard, Cal Expo, Sacramento. And the Santa Cruz Puma Project presentation is coming up on Wednesday, December 4th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Loudon Nelson Center Auditorium. Join us for a presentation of the Santa Cruz Puma Project. Wildlife ecologist Chris Wilmers will discuss his study of mountain lion habitat fragmentation in the Santa Cruz Mountains, including the process of applying GPS tag collars, information on where those lions are going, and the effects of roads and houses on mountain lions. Visit santacruzpumas.org for more details on the study. If you want to go to the presentation, you need to register at scpumaprojectpresentation.eventbrite.com for free tickets to attend the presentation. Once again, to get tickets, it's scpumaprojectpresentation.eventbrite.com. That presentation, once again, is Wednesday, December 4th from 7 to 8:30 at the Loudon Nelson Auditorium. And unfortunately, one of those mountain lions has been killed on Highway 17 in this story by Jason Hoppen of the Scotts Valley Senile. Santa Cruz's famous downtown mountain lion was struck and killed while crossing Highway 17 early last Thursday morning near Vine Hill Road. The lion's body was given to UC Santa Cruz researchers who helped capture the wayward puma in June and fitted it with a tracking collar. The juvenile male crossed Highway 17 several times in the months since its downtown excursion. He may have just been exploring, said Yiwei Wang, a UCSC doctoral candidate who works with the Santa Cruz Puma Project. He was still pretty young. As a subadult male, the mountain lion faced an uncertain future as it tried to establish itself in the wild. It had recently been exploring areas once occupied by Atlas, a massive mountain lion who once claimed an expansive territory bisected by Highway 17. Atlas, known to researchers as 16M, was shot and killed around Thanksgiving 2012 after eating domestic sheep. He had forged a reputation as a survivor after being severely wounded by a car on Highway 17. He had ignored his wounds to expand his territory even further. The downtown puma, now known as 39M, became a national sensation after wandering into a Santa Cruz aqueduct, venturing almost to Ocean Street, before Santa Cruz police halted his progress and facilitated his capture. The non-lethal approach earned statewide praise and came after law enforcement in Half Moon Bay were roundly criticized for killing two cubs who wandered into their city. The state legislature later passed a bill encouraging non-lethal responses by public safety officials when mountain lions don't pose an imminent threat to public safety. Those aren't the only threats to lion, and UCSC researchers are looking at the intersection of wildlife habitat and urban boundaries. Pumas can be shot for harassing domestic animals, and highways pose a big threat. Just days ago, a female mountain lion was killed on Interstate 280 in San Jose. Mountain lions frequently cross Highway 17 between Lexington Reservoir and Los Gatos and between Vine Hill Road and Laurel Curve in the Santa Cruz County. A state Fish and Wildlife spokeswoman said the incident happened overnight, and it appears that 39M was struck by several vehicles. Not only was Atlas struck on the same road, but a pregnant female puma was also killed there. Another mountain lion was killed on Graham Hill Road in August. Road crossings are one of the more obvious impacts of urbanization, Wang said. Sometimes you can find a straightforward solution, straightforward if you have the funding. The Laurel Curve crossing point is particularly troublesome for mountain lions. Caltrans improvements to the road resulted in removal of a large culvert that had served as an underground passage, and the recent installation of safety barriers made travel safer for cars, but much more treacherous for pumas. Fish Wildlife, Caltrans, and wildlife researchers are looking into ways to find safer passage for apex predators and other large wildlife. Locally, those efforts are starting to look specifically at Laurel Curve, with Santa Cruz-based Land Trust of Santa Cruz County interested in the project. It's not a fully developed project yet, Land Trust Executive Director Terry Corwin said. We're working with Caltrans and we'll be buying property near Laurel Curve with the intent of creating an underground passage. And also locally, big tree advocates have filed suit against the city of Santa Cruz. In this story by J.M. Brown of the Scotts Valley Senile. An advocacy group filed a lawsuit a week ago Friday against the city of Santa Cruz seeking to block recent provisions allowing the removal of heritage trees that are non-native or pose an economic hardship to property owners. Save Our Big Trees, which argues the rule changes approved by the city council would encourage the felling of more trees, argues the city should have conducted a full review of impacts as outlined in the state's landmark environmental law. While the city's elected officials may ultimately have the power to loosen the rules protecting heritage trees, it must do so in compliance with the California Environmental Quality Act and analyze the impact of their decision so that they and the public know the consequences of their actions, said Ryan Maroney, attorney for Save Our Big Trees. Maroney, a lawyer with the Santa Cruz firm of Whitworth Parkin, added, "The city's shoot first and ask questions later approach here is precisely what CEQA was enacted to prevent." Unquote. The council postponed the suggested changes in July after Maroney sent a last-minute letter objecting to the lack of environmental review. After the city's environmental attorney advised that a full analysis wasn't required, the council approved the changes October 22nd by a vote of 4-2. The provisions are set to go into effect on November 23rd. Even if the city ultimately determined greater flexibility in the ordinance was needed, Bernal said city leaders tried to work with Save Our Big Trees. The city council and staff took their concerns very, very seriously, he said. Passed in 1994, the Heritage Tree Ordinance safeguards trees that are 44 inches or larger in circumference, as measured 54 inches from the ground, or those that have historic or aesthetic significance. Yet the vast majority of applications made by property owners to remove heritage trees are granted, with more than 4,000 taken out since the ordinance was established. Trees can be removed if they pose a significant public safety risk, are in poor health, and the new allowances provide for health risks such as allergies and fire risks posed by non-native blue gum eucalyptus and acacia trees. Save Our Big Trees supporters say the flammability of the non-native species has been overstated and argues that if the city is creating greater leeway to take out trees, the impact on wildlife and carbon sequestration should be studied. To be clear, Save Our Big Trees supports the democratic process, and environmental review is at the heart of that democratic process, said member Jillian Griesite. And a Southern California man has been charged in commercial fishing violations. California's Department of Fish and Wildlife filed dozens of misdemeanor charges in October against a Southern California man, accusing him of violating a series of commercial fishing regulations. Adam Crawford James, age 32, of Winnetka, is accused of multiple violations of the California Fish and Game Code, including commercial take of lobster without a permit, commercial take of sea urchins without a permit, illegal take of nearshore fish without a permit, failure to complete or submit records of fish taken under a commercial license, illegal take of several varieties of fish during closed commercial season, and several other serious charges. During their investigation, California Department of Fish and Wildlife officers received information from the CalTIP hotline that James was attempting to sell commercially caught fish to restaurants without a receiver's license. In California, commercial fishermen are permitted to sell their catch directly to restaurants, provided the restaurant has a receiver's license and has completed required documentation of the marine life that is taken. This management tool helps to protect the resource and ensure sustainable fisheries for years to come. The investigation revealed that James appeared to be in violation of far more when evidence of fishing during closed seasons and taking of species that require special permits began to surface. Most commercial fishermen are ethical and diligently follow the laws and regulations, said CADFW Assistant Chief Dan Zvorsa. Thanks to the information received from the CalTIP hotline and good solid police work, we were able to file charges. The charges were filed with the Santa Monica City Attorney's Office in October. If convicted of these violations in court, James could face jail time, fines, loss of his commercial fishing license, community service, and other penalties. No court dates have yet been set. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. Earlier in the season than we would have imagined, the blood of the buffalo has begun to spill. Since our last writing, at least 14 of America's last wild buffalo were killed by treaty hunters with the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. This particular migration from Yellowstone into Montana is unusual in how early it is. Rather than the buffalo's early arrival being a source for celebration, this particular journey was met with fatal consequences. Years ago, this killing would have been done by the Montana Department of Livestock. Instead, they sit back and smile as the most unlikely ones, the relatives of the buffalo, do their dirty deeds for them in the name of sovereignty. To complicate matters, Montana passed a law earlier this year that allows officials to reveal the locations of buffalo to state and treaty hunters. Tribes hunting under treaty rights set their own quotas and seasons, which span from September to April. The Montana state hunt begins next Friday, November 15th, and will last for 3 months until February 15th, 2014, while buffalo will be under the gun for a full 6 months. The day before the first ever National Bison Day was to be celebrated, one relative spoke out strongly against these killings and for the protection of his buffalo kin, appealing to all First Nations. Here is the letter from Blackfeet Confederacy spiritual leader and holy paint gatherer Jimmy St. Goddard. to the chairs and presidents of Indian nations, Indian leaders, and government officials. The Buffalo, Iniwa, have asked me to convey this message. We know you respect the buffalo. We know you have the right to hunt the buffalo. But the ancient buffalo in Yellowstone have been decimated and have not recovered. In the Hayden and Pelican Valleys in the central interior of Yellowstone National Park, the buffalo have felt the brunt of this slaughter. Their population is well under half of what it was just a few winters ago. We need to send a message to the whites. We need to send a message to the white governments to let this ancient buffalo herd regenerate itself. Your own tribal policies and laws allow you to step back and reassess the situation. We have to get away from the thinking that if we don't do anything, we will lose our treaty rights. Done properly, a resolution by the tribes to place a moratorium on hunting the buffalo will strengthen our treaty and cultural rights. In a sacred way, we ask that you adopt 1 or 2 year moratorium on hunting the buffalo to be set by your cultural leadership, specifically to your tribal government. This year and next year, our cultures will grow, the buffalo will recover, and our children will learn that there is a way to bring the Iniwa back. Your treaty rights will always be in place to hunt on public lands, to see and let our sacred animal grow again, multiply for the future generations. I ask this in the Blackfeet Nasistapi real people way. I want to share this message with the tribal leaders that will accept this moratorium on the Yellowstone buffalo herd. In February of 2012, I met with Senator Daniel Inouye in Washington, D.C. Daniel asked me what the tribes could do to stay stronger, and he said that just one thing that the tribes could do that no one could ever break, not even the U.S. government, is for the tribes to stand together with their traditions. I just wanted to share his message with you, tribal leader. The late Senator Daniel Inouye said for us to stand together with our traditions. There is also a sacred 8 or 9 year old bull in the herd that must be protected. I ask you, as the former culture chairman of the Blackfeet tribe and ongoing spiritual leader of the Eloise Cobell case, I also want to reintroduce myself to your honorable council, that I am one of the spiritual leaders of the Blackfoot Confederacy that encompasses the United States and Canada. I am in no way influenced by the U.S. government or any other entity that has not understood our ancient traditional ways. I have been through most or all of the Eloise Cobell case. I have survived the Bush administration. I carry on our ancient traditions for my people. I ask that your brilliant cultural minds implement this moratorium to save our sacred buffalo and pray that this resolution or moratorium will be implemented as soon as possible. James St. Goddard, Isukya, Holy Paint Gatherer, one of the ancient Blackfeet. If you want more information, I ask you to go to the Buffalo Field Campaign's website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. If you have a donation or something of value that you want to send to the Buffalo Field Campaign, check on their website. They have plenty of needs with the upcoming winter campaign getting started. And when you figure that out, send it to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. If you have any questions, give them a call at area code 406-646-0070. And once again, the website is www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And I ask you to remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And anti-whaling activist Paul Watson is testifying in a U.S. court in this story by Gene Johnson of the Associated Press. A fugitive activist known for attacking Japanese whaling vessels off of Antarctica insisted, quote, "We're not pirates," Wednesday, as he addressed a U.S. appeals court considering whether he and the organization he founded should be held in contempt. Paul Watson, the Canadian founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, took the witness stand in a Seattle courtroom. Japanese whalers accused them of violating a court order demanding that they leave the whalers alone. "We don't care what people call us," Watson said, responding to an earlier ruling from the court that called the activists pirates. We're not pirates. Protesting against illegal activity is not piracy. The white goateed 62-year-old described his history of environmental activism and accolades and said he'd spent the past year at sea. He fled Germany in 2012 after being arrested at the behest of the Costa Rican government, and Japan continues to seek his arrest related to his interference with a whaling vessel in 2010. Over the last year, there's been a lot of negotiation on different levels that allowed me to come ashore, he said in response to a question from his lawyer. Watson did not elaborate, and it remained unclear whether he might still face arrest. The case is part of a long-running fight between the protesters and Japan's whaling fleet, which kills up to 1,000 whales a year, as allowed by the International Whaling Commission. Japan is permitted to hunt the animals as long as they are killed for research and not commercial purposes, but whale meat not used for study is sold as food in Japan. Critics say that's the real reason for the hunts, which they view as illegal. For several years, Sea Shepherd operated anti-whaling campaigns in the Southern Ocean. Activists aboard its vessels would hurl acid and smoke bombs at the whalers and drag ropes in the water to damage their propellers. They claim to have saved thousands of whales. Last December, just before the whaling season was to begin, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ordered Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, Watson, and anyone acting in concert with them to keep a half kilometer away from whaling vessels. Japanese whalers argue that the organization violated that order 10 times earlier this year, including the deliberate ramming of a fuel ship by a protest vessel. Sea Shepherd denies that account, saying the protest vessel was simply trying to block the refueling of a whaling ship when the whaling ship boxed it in. The whalers asked the court to impose fines of $100,000 for each violation, though they suggested the court waive those fines as long as the protesters stopped confronting their ships. In response to the injunction, Sea Shepherd says it withdrew from any participation in the anti-whaling campaign, and Watson stepped down from the organization. Instead, Watson and Sea Shepherd said its cousin, Sea Shepherd of Australia Limited, took over, and that organization insists that it wasn't subject to the court's order. The hearing in Seattle, which began last week, is aimed in part at determining whether the Australian organization carried out the protest in concert with Sea Shepherd. The whalers argue that the distinction between the Sea Shepherd and its Australian counterpart is largely fictional. Sea Shepherd has spent about $2.5 million preparing for the protest, including the cost of fuel and ship crews eventually used in the protest. Watson, whose exploits have been featured on the Animal Planet reality television show Whale Wars, insisted that it was important for him to comply with the injunction. But by the time the injunction was issued, he was already on board one of the protest vessels. He remained on board only as an observer, he said, and at one point urged Sea Shepherd of Australia to abide by the court's injunction. He also argued in court Wednesday that although the injunction ordered the protesters to keep 500 yards from the whalers, it didn't say anything about whether the Japanese whaling ships could come within 500 yards of us. During cross-examination, John Newport, a lawyer for the whalers, suggested it was odd for Watson to resign from Sea Shepherd and his overall command of 4 protest vessels, when if he had remained in charge, he could have ensured that the vessels complied with the injunction. Watson said he didn't believe he could have ensured compliance with that order. The captains of the ships were likely to intervene if they believed a whale's life was at stake, he said. He fled from Germany last year after being arrested at the behest of the Costa Rican government, which is pursuing him on a warrant that claims he endangered a fishing crew in 2002. He has said he believes the arrest was made under pressure from Japan and that he eventually would have been extradited there if he had remained in Germany. Jeff Hansen, director of Sea Shepherd of Australia, testified Tuesday that his organization did not coordinate with the American Sea Shepherd Group after the injunction was issued. He said he does not believe the U.S. courts have jurisdiction over international waters. No disrespect, of course, he told the judge. And he vowed that no matter what the U.S. court rules, his organization will forge ahead with plans to challenge the Japanese whaling fleet early next year. We're answering to our clients, which are the whales, he said. And loggers face removal from the land of Earth's most threatened tribe in this story from Survival International. Brazil has taken steps toward the removal of thousands of illegal loggers and settlers from the land of the Awá, Earth's most threatened tribe by notifying them that they will be removed if they do not leave now. Survival has received reports that FUNAI, the Brazilian government's Indian Affairs Department, is advising settlers who have illegally cleared rainforest for farming not to plant new crops, as they will have to leave before the next harvest. The Awá are one of Brazil's last nomadic tribes. They have been driven to the brink of extinction as waves of illegal loggers, settlers, and ranchers have flooded their land since the 1970s. The invaders have destroyed vast swaths of the tribe's forest and massacred entire Awá families. Evicting the illegal invaders is becoming increasingly urgent as the rainy season will start in December, making it impossible for the government's ground teams to carry out the evictions. As news of the imminent evictions is spreading, ranchers and loggers are staging protests against their removal and calling for the Awá's land to lose its status as an indigenous territory. Some claim that the Awá do not exist. A ground operation against deforestation around the Awá's land was launched in June 2013, but failed to remove loggers from the Awá territory where illegal logging is most acute. One Awá man told Survival, "We're very worried. It's really bad that the loggers are stealing our food. Justice Minister, help us now, please. Send in the police now." Brazil's Minister of Justice has received over 54,000 letters from Survival supporters worldwide and is also receiving a daily Awá Icon photo to urge him to take action. Following the petition submitted by Survival and Brazilian NGO CMII, the government is being investigated by the America's leading human rights body over the plight of the Awá. Many celebrities, including Hollywood star Gillian Anderson, British fashion designer Vivienne Westwood, and Brazilian photographer Sebastião Salgado, and the actor Colin Firth are also supporting the campaign. Survival's director Stephen Corey said today, as thousands of visitors prepare to visit for the World Cup, the international spotlight is on the Justice Ministry. Brazil risks greatly damaging its reputation over eviction delays. Can the government uphold its commitment to kick illegal invaders out before the rains start? And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast or download a podcast of the Earth First Update, you could go to one of the following sites. You could listen in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz webcast. You could go to the website radioforall.net. That's the radio number forall.net. Search for Earth First Update. Or you could listen to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, Idaho, on their new frequency, 90.3 FM. And they've also got more power. And they rebroadcast this show on Monday nights at 9:30 p.m. All right, that's all the time we have. Thank you for listening, and do tune in next week to the next Earth First Update.